Hello folks, welcome back, and if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. You're listening to the High Performance Human Podcast, and I'm your host, Simon Ward. Before we start, I just wanted to let you know that you are a high performance human. The concept of high performance is described as a measurable state where an individual consistently performs at a higher level of operational success compared with most of their peers in the same environment and at a similar time. But it's not absolute, it's relative. And if you're an endurance athlete and you train or compete regularly, please don't just compare yourself against all of those other athletes. Instead, think about other folks of your age. Compared to them, you are operating at a very high level. Now, I appreciate that you might want to improve on this still. And if that's the case, we'd love to help you. It could be sleep, your nutrition, physical activity, personal relationships, work habits, and so much more. I've currently got availability to take on one or two clients, and my wife Beth, who's a certified life coach, also has some availability. So, depending on what you're looking to focus on, we have you covered, and you can find contact details in the show notes. Okay then, on with this week's guest. Now, I really enjoy having podcast guests on the show who've been involved in triathlon for a long time, and this week's guest has shown remarkable resilience to have raced in the sport for 41 consecutive years. Mark Kleanthas first took part in a triathlon way back in 1983, and since then, Mark's completed an impressive 535 triathlons in more than 20 countries, including finishing the Hawaii Ironman World Championships. And he's also competed and completed 48 iron distance double and one triple Ironman triathlon. He's also finished 71 marathons in under 3 hours. In the last 41 triathlon seasons, Mark's calculated that he covered more than 12,000 miles of swimming, 198,000 miles of cycling, and run more than 61,000 miles. That's a total of 271,000 miles, both training and racing for triathlon, which is more than 11 times the distance around the world, or more than the distance to the moon. Whew, I'm exhausted just reading that. So let's crack on and hear from Mark so I can have a breather. Welcome to the show, Mark Kleanthas.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you here, Mark. I feel like you and I have been around in triathlon since the beginning of time.
It seems that way, doesn't it? When you actually look back at what triathlon was like last century and what it's like this century, it seems a different sport.
I mean, you know, I started with my first triathlon in 1987. You were around a bit before me, weren't you? 1983. We had Margaret Sills on recently, who started in 1983. She's retired. You're still going?
I'm still going. So this will be my 42nd consecutive season competing in triathlons. I did 29 different seasons competing in at least one iron distance triathlon. So, I enjoy competing.
Is that what keeps you going? Is it the competition more than anything else?
No, it's I actually enjoy the process, the journey. I love competing. I love raising my performance on race day and working out on race day. It's such a long event, whether it's a middle distance, an Ironman, or longer when I've done a double or a triple, that it's such a long event that you can make changes during the event to affect the outcome. So if you get a puncture, as long as you are relaxed and are positive about that scenario, it often doesn't affect the outcome. So if I've had a puncture, the first thing I will think about is finding some shade if it's a hot event, starting to eat a solid bar, and then the next phase of action would be to focus on the puncture, not look at all the other competitors going by, and just focus on and be pleased with my performance of fixing the puncture and getting back on the road.
Yeah, and that's a real focus on the execution, isn't it? So, like you say, the actual process and nailing everything right, regardless of whether it's pacing yourself correctly on the run or just getting all those other little things done, like, okay, so I've got a puncture, those things happen, and am I going to panic and throw my toys out the court, or am I just going to deal with it and then get on with it like you would if you're on a training ride?
Yeah, I think I wasn't very good in my early 20s when something like that happened, or a marshal probably didn't send you in the right direction. You had to go around the roundabout again. But I'm a lot more relaxed and having marshalled up more than sort of 50 events, I understand that side of it as well. So it's quite important to realise that things, and when you hear of the winners, you know, their race was never perfect, whether it's the build up, the bike not arriving on time, problems racking their bike, or even finding their race bag on race morning, they still managed to win. So, and I look at so many people that have had a penalty, been in the penalty tent, still won. Katrina Morrison, for example, she broke her chain in Ironman Lanzarote and managed to get the technical guys to fix the chain and still went on to win it. So that, I mean, that shows a lot of maturity and confidence and everything else that goes with it, really. So, and once you're exposed to that scenario where, you know, people have had an injury, like Lucy Charles, you know, which could be support changing, life changing, and they still managed to achieve a goal, you know, that journey is so much sweeter for them. And that's what drives me on, really, because it's never a linear progress with fitness and health and getting faster and stronger. Sometimes you get your peaks and your troughs, and it's just listening to your body, really.
Well, there's a couple of things in there, Mark. I suppose that just on that immediate thing you just said there is when you've been racing for 41 years consecutively and done as many events as you have, there must be a realization very early on that you're not going to keep getting quicker and faster at every one. And so you have to have another way of measuring satisfaction. Otherwise, you will end up frustrated at some point.
Yes, you will. I mean, sometimes I've been more pleased with a 13-hour Ironman than I have been a sub-10-hour Ironman, just because the build-up hasn't got, life's got in the way, work, whatever, and you've not been able to get to the fitness level you wanted to, but you've actually almost executed a perfect race. You've paced yourself really well. You've nailed all that nutrition, the hydration, and you've been really strong at the end of the race. And you think, wow, if I'd have been really fit, I could have done this, this, and this. But I learn from, I call them errors, really. I tend not to make the same error twice, because if you make the same error twice, that tends to be a mistake.
Yes.
I tend to learn from, think, right, that's an experience. Okay, maybe I seated myself wrong in the swim, or I didn't have the right swim goggles on and the light changed. And I learned from that. And because I don't beat myself up with that, I'm using that for my next race. And in terms of, yes, the tender age of 63, I'm not going to be as quick as I was when I was 23. You know, I look back at, say, 2012, when I did the inaugural Ironman Sweden, and looking back at my diaries and my training plans and my training, I was definitely slower at swimming than I was in 1987, say, or 85. I was definitely slower cycling, but I had a slightly better bike. I had a better wetsuit, for example, and my run was definitely a lot slower. And that's where the running seems to be the decline of the three sports. Mm-hmm. 25 years, my ambition was to try and match my 1987 time to my 2012 time. And 25 years later, on a different course, I managed to go 26 minutes quicker.
Wow.
But individually, my swim, my bike and run were slower than they were 25 years ago. I just think I got my taper right. I got my nutrition right. My bike performance was better. My run was a little bit slower, but not too much slower. So I was more pleased with that than I would have been maybe a sub 10-hour race that was 40 minutes quicker, just because I was that much older and I expected a certain performance, and I was able to achieve the best performance in the swim, the best on the bike, and the best on the run on that day.
And I guess that's the thing that you and I have observed as coaches as well, isn't it, is that having the fastest bike swim, well, that doesn't really have much influence on your race. You probably, you know, most people could chop a few minutes off if they hammered themselves on the swim, but it's not going to be a massive difference. Having the fastest bike split compared to your previous ones can often take away from your run. And the wisdom and experience that you've gained in all of those events is knowing that actually, if I can hold back and you've got the confidence to hold back, that probably is going to result in a better run. And it always amuses me when I listen to cyclists saying, what was your bike split? And I'm like, what was your time crossing the finish line? You know, your bike split's irrelevant if you took 10 hours to walk the 26 miles.
Yeah, and so people often say to me, what's your best time for Lanzarote? And that was 10 hours, 50 minutes. But they don't necessarily ask me what my swim or my bike or my run time was. They're interested in the total. And I could have overcooked it on the bike and got under 6 hours for the bike, but then I wouldn't have run a 3:26 marathon.
Yeah.
So it's trying to find that balance. And sometimes I've not been competitive on the bike. I mean, partly that's because I've not got a bike sponsor. I don't have to get a fast bike split. Just right. My sponsors' options. And held back on the bike and made sure I've had my nutrition, I had my food, and if, especially if it's an age group athlete in my age group, I look at them and I think they've actually still got this. It could be 150 cans to the bike. They've still got their two drinks bottles because they're not the sponsored drinks bottles. They've got the ones they started with, and you can see that they've got all their food stuck on their top tube. So you think, well, they're going to struggle at some stage pretty soon because they're not drinking as much as they need to because it's 30 degrees and they're not eating as much as they need to. And you know, you get off the bike and very soon they're walking the rest of it. Now that could have been, they might have had an Achilles injury or something where they physically know they're not going to run the marathon, so they've decided to hammer the bike. But even so, all those little things I really take pride with, because I think actually people are making errors that are not necessary.
Well, that sort of takes me back to what you were saying earlier about when you get a puncture. You know, sometimes those things happen no matter how many precautions you take. And so you just, you know, you make sure that you can change a puncture swiftly. You make sure that if you've just put new tires on, you can actually get them off again. Because I've seen people who were great at fixing punctures, but they put new tires on and they're so tight, they can't physically get the strength in their fingers to get them off under pressure. Or they've been descending a lot and the rims are too hot for them to hold, so they have to wait a bit, you know. So there are little things like that that people don't talk about. But then, as you say, in your head you think, I'm losing this race, I'm getting behind, you know, I'm not going to win my age group, not going to get that qualification spot. But there's lots of time for things to unfold. Mishaps can happen to other people. Somebody can lose their energy bars. Somebody can appear to be going fast, like you said, because they're not drinking. And then all of a sudden they come to a stop on the run. And, you know, so losing your focus because something's happened to you is a learning experience that you don't need to do it, because those things will happen to other people and it'll all sort of come out in the wash at the end, won't it? And I'm sure that you've experienced that when you think, well, this chance has gone now. And then all of a sudden there you are back in the top three.
Yeah, and that's happened a few times where I've gone off course and had to come back on the course and still managed to, or someone's crashed at Staffordshire 70.3 and I've stopped to help them and I thought, well, now I'm out of the race and I still managed third overall. And I think, well, sometimes that, but I ran well, maybe because I got off the bike and I'd stopped and, you know, and I was able to have a bit of a mini break, really. So sometimes things can work in your favour as opposed to, but I've learned that when something, I think with triathlon as well, it does seem to attract a whole range of people, but it certainly attracts the people that either are problem solvers or they're not good problem solvers. They just overcome something when it happens. So going back to the, I put two new tires on my bike. If they're tubulars, I'd pre-stretch them on another set of wheels so they're easy to get on and off. If I'm using clinchers, I'll make sure that the new tires are stretched. I wouldn't change them the week before. I change them a few weeks before to make sure that, you know, they're bedded in and I'm going over. I might deliberately go over potholes and things just to make sure that they're not pinched inside and things. So it's all those little extra things, you know, making the bike nice and heavy in the winter or going out on a winter bike. So I don't necessarily need to train hard, but when I got on my racing bike, it feels that much better. So I'm always trying different ways to make it sport specific. So if you haven't got time to train in the gym as well as the swim, bike and run, you know, I'd use hand paddles for swim strength. I'd ride a mountain bike, ride off road, make the bike really heavy, make my sit up a lot more, more than be aero at certain times and run off road and muddy sections just to give you that extra sport specific strength. And as I've got older, I found I've needed that more than I did when I was in my 20s.
Well, let's go back to those 20s then, Mark. So if you've been, you're 63 now, so you've been at it for 42 years. So what, were you 21 when you first did your first one? 21, 20?
Yeah, just turned 22.
Okay, so I spoke to Steve True recently, and he was telling me about finding out that Northampton race that you and I were discussing, and he said he'd been doing the Wolverhampton Marathon, and some guy said he was using the marathon to train for this triathlon. How did you find out about your first race, and what were you doing at the time that made you think, oh, I can do that?
I've been running marathons since the first London Marathon in 1981, and I was looking for a bit of another challenge, and that whether that being an ultra distance run or something completely different. I couldn't swim at that stage. I was a pretty poor swimmer at school, and if you're a poor swimmer at school, you were just left in the shallow end to play with your mates, and the rest of them were learn to swim. Mm-hmm. Then I saw an ad in Athletics Weekly for to compete in a triathlon, and there was a triathlon training day in the spring of 1983 for the Reading Triathlon, and that was actually at Reading. So we swam in a swimming pool, and God, you could see who were the swimmers and who were the fish, and who weren't swimmers. So I very quickly learned that I couldn't swim at all. So I had about 12 weeks to learn how to swim. There was no wetsuits back then, so you didn't have the security of a wetsuit. And then we cycled around the Reading track at that time, and we went for a run on the running track. And I actually felt that my running and my cycling was better than average, I would say, but my swimming was very diabolical. So I soon decided that I needed to go away and join a swimming club or somewhere where I could actually get some coaching. But there was certainly no triathlon coaches, because the first triathlon really hadn't been held in the UK. Most swimmers were really only interested in you doing all four strokes. And by that time, I'd only had about 9 weeks left to go. And I didn't have time to learn four strokes. I only had time to learn one stroke, really. So then I started commuting to work by bike instead of running to work and running back, and entered the first Reading Triathlon in 1983. No wetsuits were allowed then. Well, in fact, they weren't even developed, really. And the swim organizer, because it was a swim organizer, a bike organizer, and a run organizer, the swim organizer definitely didn't want you to wear wetsuits, because we felt that would be an advantage. But actually, looking back at some of the wetsuits we could have used, that would have been no good anyway.
What were the distances of that first race, Mark? Because we didn't have Olympic distance then, did we? Because triathlon wasn't anywhere near being in the Olympics.
Well, that was 1983, so that's 17 years before it was first in the Olympics. So the organisers just decided where they could have left-hand turns on the bike, where they could have a nice, safe run. So the Reading Triathlon was supposed to be a 1 mile swim, 1600 meter swim, a 41 mile cycle, and a half marathon. Because the temperature was so cold the first week of June, they decided to drop the swim down to 1000 meters rather than 1600 meters. The bike still remained 40 miles. There was no feed stations on the run, and you were allowed to have a relative or a friend or someone cycle next to you and give you drinks. There was no transition per se. Bikes were just left in on the grass. You could actually have friends and family help you get dressed. Mm-hmm. But back then, there weren't many novice people. They were either marathon runners or either cyclists or swimmers. The only real athlete was Danny Nightingale, and he'd gone to the Olympics and won a gold medal for modern pentathlon. Mm-hmm. But most of the other people had never actually, prior to the triathlon being announced, they never did any other sport apart from their own sport. They may have been a swimmer and gone into cycling, but no one really had any specialist. Well, wasn't a specialist in two sports. They're only a specialist in one. So the all the swimmers came out fast and then got caught on the bike in the run. All the cyclists were okay or not so okay on the swim, but overtook everyone on the bike and got caught on the run. And then all the runners took in that race 2.5 hours before they got to their best in the run.
Well, and of course, I bet the runners thought, as long as I can survive the swim and get around the bike, I'll be able to catch them up. But bearing in mind that nobody had any idea about pacing then, they would have been playing catch up, and then probably horrified to find that as they got off the bike, they had these wooden legs that they'd never experienced before, and they weren't going to make up the gains in the run that they thought they would.
Well, that's what happened, because there was no pacing involved. It was your first ever event. You had no idea that you could. I finished eighth in that race, and I think had I come out the swim and gone steady on the bike and gone steady in the run, I would have probably finished higher. But because I was so far back from the swim and I was doing breaststroke and I could see some of the swimmers were getting out and I was only at the second turn, you know, they were sort of even 1,000 meters. I think I did 32 minutes for 1,000 meters, which is like 3 minute 100 pace. And the top swimmers were 13, 14 minutes, like Mickey Flaherty and people.
Yeah.
So they had huge advantage. And plus, you know, hypothermia was starting to set in really at that stage because I was a skinny marathon runner.
Mm. Yeah, I'm thinking back to my first triathlon. I remember Adrian Morehouse did the one in Leeds. You know, he was Olympic gold medalist, but he was a Leeds lad. I think he did some cross-country running as a kid, and he would have had a good aerobic engine, obviously. I think he came seventh, but I don't think he would have done any triathlon training. And this was a pool event. It was a hybrid. You got the run came before the bike. You got 15 minutes between each section to sort of go and get your kit and make your way to the start of the next one. And I can just remember some of those early years, you know, not long after you've started, maybe towards the end of the 80s, when you and I would probably be going to Swindon and Staffordshire Moorlands and Windsor, and seeing people like Robin Brew, who obviously was an Olympic swimmer. I'm trying to think of some of the people who were really good on the bike. Mark Marabini was a good sort of reasonable all-rounder, wasn't he? John Ashby. But the sport was definitely lopsided in those days between sports specialists who then just survived on the others.
Well, yeah, and because the distance, as you say, Simon, they weren't the standard 1500, 40k, 10k. Often it would be if it was more bike emphasis, the cyclist would do much better, really, than say the runner or the swimmer. And swims were often, the distances were changing almost daily before the race. I remember the one at Home Pierpoint, the middle distance, where Sarah Springman was sixth and Paula Newbury-Fraser was fifth overall. They actually, instead of making the swim a mile and a half, they made it 2 miles because they just put the boys in the wrong way. And then some events, they measured the swim in nautical miles rather than metric miles, imperial miles. So it made the swim that much longer. So the swimmers never complained, but the runners did complain.
I can remember that. I think that happened at the first San Diego, like 70.3, didn't it? Ironman 70.3 down there. It was at Camp Pendleton, and the Marines measured it all out, and it was a super long swim, and nobody could work out why until they realised that it was nautical miles that the Marines had measured it in.
Yeah, it's funny that way, isn't it, really? But and then some events, even like Chasewater, I'd often offer to help out the day before and put the boys out, and purely that was because then I could be at that boy and just before the boat moved to the next boy, put my head at waterline for like a sighting point. Mm-hmm. Not that I would be a Robin Bruin lead swim, but I'd like to know where I'm going, really, and swim in the shortest legal possible line.
Yeah. Can you remember what it was like to enter races back in those early days, Mark? Because I think for folks that have come to sport in the last few years where everything's online and you can pretty much have selected and put all your details in and paid for a race within a few minutes, it was a little bit more drawn out back in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, to get your entry details back or where the start was and the course, often you'd have to send your event details through two self-addressed envelopes, one for the race details and then one for your race results. And you wouldn't hear back for weeks and weeks and weeks. You never knew if they got your, there was no telephone number, no landline number. There was certainly no mobiles back then. And then you get your details through race week, and it's quite exciting to sort of see them. And then you get your audience survey map out. There was no internet then to you know, try and plot the route, and could I possibly go by and train? And I never had a car back then, and cycle around the route or go and check the course out. And then you do the race. I had no idea where you finished. Neither did the organisers in many cases. And then you waited weeks for the results to come through. And if it was a big field, and the results were on a typewriter, you often the first two or three pages were on one font type, and then the next three or four pages would be on someone else's different typewriter, and the last few pages may be on the first person's typewriter. And there was only three splits then. It was always a swim, it was always a bike and the run, and the bike included the coming out of the lake to transition, and getting back into transition off the bike and starting the run. So it was very difficult, actually. You could always see how well or how poorly you did in the swim, how well or how poorly you did on the run, but you never knew how well you did on the bike, because you could have had the fastest bike ride, but if you took, so you had to dry your hair and use a towel and cover your bits up, because you change between the three different disciplines. So it was difficult to know if your transitions were good or if your bike split was good. Or I know some people were very quick at cycling, but their transitions were very, very poor. But back then, we treated it as three sports.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to come to next, actually, Mark. You made mention earlier the fact that there were no triathlon coaches back then. I think the first book that I ever found about triathlon training was Dave Scott's Triathlon Training Bible. And I tried to follow some of his routines and very quickly got injured. You know, it was like 6 times 1 mile at 4 minutes per, or 4.5 minutes per mile pace, you know, with a 60-second recovery. I couldn't do 1 mile at 4.5 minute pace back then. But that was about it. And then I got Mark Allen's triathlon training book, and that was pretty similar to Dave's, just with a bit more holistic stuff in it. And then I got a few others, but the first person I ever came across who was a full-time triathlon coach was Chris Jones, I think, and that wasn't until the mid-90s. So you're right. It was, you go a bit like you described earlier, you go down to local swim club and swim with the swimmers and just, you know, hope they didn't ask you to do breaststroke or butterfly. You then go out cycling with your cycling club on a weekend and do the time trials midweek. And then you join a running club and you go to the track once a week and do cross country in the winter. And then you try to, and then you, because we were trying to train like individual disciplines, then everybody was trying to do lots of training and wondering why they were always getting ill or injured.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I could follow some of Dave Scott's book. I got him to sign it back in 1987 when he came to Cambridge. But I was a 31-minute 10K runner, 2:24 marathon runner. So I could actually do the run sessions, but I couldn't do the swim sessions.
I was going to say, I bet he couldn't do his swim sets, because Dave was a master swimmer anyway, wasn't he? So I think he was probably an NCAA swimmer.
Yeah. But, I found all those books quite interesting, but that they weren't really relatable to me, really.
No.
Because I didn't have that swimming background. I didn't have that. I hadn't gone through the track and field at school. I just took up marathon running just because the first London Marathon came along. I had no real sort of sports experience. But I found them very interesting in terms of, you know, and if it's good enough for Dave, it should have been good enough for me. But a lot, some of the book helped, but unfortunately some of it I couldn't really follow.
He was a hard case, wasn't he, Dave? And he pushed himself hard as well. And I've since got to know Dave personally and had long chats with him about all of that. And I keep saying to him, were all those things they wrote about you, were they myths, Dave? And he went, oh no, it was all true. Even to the bit about washing his cottage sheet. Well, that was a bit of a joke, wasn't it? I think somebody had come along to do an interview for him before Kona, and He was trying to get inside Mark Allen's head, so he told them, "Oh, I'm even washing the cottage cheese." And he said, "I never thought they'd write it down, but they did."
Yeah, I remember speaking to him at the triathlon show, and he did say that was just, just something he thought up and used to get inside Mark Allen's head, really.
Can you going back to the early 80s or the late 80s and early 90s then, Mark, what were your favourite races around then? Because I doubt if any of them are really, I doubt if any of them are really still going, are they? Maybe Windsor's probably still existing in some format.
Well, King's Lynn was a quite a popular one. Hunstanton, where they banned the race organiser. I just felt, well, if I can get through the swim, I'll be okay.
Yeah.
And then halfway around the swim, see people that literally were hanging on to the brick wall because there was one. It was only probably only one or two safety boats. Yeah. I'm thinking, I'm going to have a good position here. I've just got to survive and not drown. And I, if I can manage to get out and manoeuvre myself to the steps on this mm-hmm. huge brick wall, there's only one exit. but and then obviously I had hypothermia. The cycle route was very scenic. One stage I thought I was leading it because I never saw anyone behind me. I never overtook anyone. And then I was on the run. You're running up and down the seafront. But
yeah.
That was quite a good one, really. I liked Ironbridge. Ironbridge was that came along a little bit later. I've raced so many times at Hope Pierpoint. I should have shares in that place, to be honest.
Well, probably at least your own groove to follow around the around the course, right?
Yeah, I've got lots of good and bad memories there, really, and bad memories probably from the weather as opposed to poor performances, really.
I used to like Ironbridge. The swim was good because you remember everybody used to get changed to transition. Then there was like a procession to walk upstream, wasn't there, to the start of the swim, through the fields full of cow dung and everything else. And then all the spectators would come up and then run down the river, banking to try and cheer you on. And there was one bit where it went, if you remember that S bend, where it went through the really shallow and if you're a purist, like I'm sure you were, you'd try and swim through it, but it was almost impossible. The best you could do was probably to drag yourself on by your hands over the rocks. But everybody else was getting up and walking. And then
that was very scenic, that swim, with all the trees overhanging and the...
Yeah, it was. But I always remember that I got ill after that race because there was a bit where you went past the power station where you could feel the water temperature went up. And I always imagined that there were these supersized bugs there from the warm water that were waiting to get into my mouth every time I breathed.
It wouldn't surprise me if the bugs would quite happily live there for a while. So, yeah.
And then I remember when you got underneath the Iron Bridge, you had to swim over to the right, didn't you, to catch hold of that rope. And if you missed it, you could end up another mile downstream.
Yeah, because there was a hell of a current coming back down. You had to be really careful to, and people were rushing to sort of get down to the finish, but not actually manoeuvring themselves to the rope. And then all of a sudden they think, well, that's one less to worry about for a while. They won't get you up.
And then you had to get out and you had to run up all those steep steps, didn't you, while you were out of breath? And then get out onto the bike. You had to come over that narrow little bridge and down through the village.
And then it's a small transition area, really, relatively small, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And then on the way back, I remember it was just that, was it three loops? You ran down one side of the river, over a bridge, back up the other side. And it was always that nasty little drag coming. Do you remember? You're just coming back up into the village. There was this nasty little drag. And then you'd go over the bridge again and off you went to do lap three, two and three.
But it was just something magical about that, running over that bridge that was, you know, apparently...
Yeah.
The first iron bridge in the world, and it was had a lot of history behind it, and so yeah, it was nice to have something, a bit of a quirkiness, so a bit like Escape from Alcatraz, which I've done.
Did you ever race there on the year that Iron Bridge, that is, when Greg Welsh raced and stopped in the pub for a sandwich?
Yes, I did. Yes.
See, now there's something that wouldn't be able to happen today.
No, it wouldn't, would it? Really, but
yeah. Okay, so Ironbridge is a good one. I enjoyed that. I did used to like Windsor. It was almost the sort of mark the start of the season. No, sorry, not Windsor, Swindon. The ones that Total Fitness used to put on at the Cotswold Water Park.
And that's where they had the 220 long, the iron distance triathlon.
That's right. So that was that the first proper iron distance in the UK, or was it?
No, Peterborough, 1985.
Oh, that was a proper iron distance, was it? Yeah. Okay.
Sponsored by Silver Spoon. Stay sweet, stay the distance was the
one. Brilliant.
And the t-shirt still fits me to this day, so I occasionally get it out for the sake of it.
Fantastic. Do you still have all your race t-shirts then?
Yes, I do actually. Yeah, I'm in the process of getting a little short video of I think I've got from 41 years from memory, I've got at least 38 different seasons. I've certainly got every Ironman triathlon t-shirt. So that's
Wow.
20, that's 29. And now I've got and I've got the one of the first ones from 1980, a couple from 1983, Nice Triathlon 1983, the Quadra 1983. Durham Long Course was 1983. First year, I actually did four triathlons that year.
40.
Four.
Oh, four. Right.
And the Reading was the shortest one, really, because Reading took 3 hours 45 minutes, because that's a 40-mile bike and a half marathon. The Quadrathon was an iron distance plus a 50-kilometer walk. So that took me 17 hours.
Wow.
The middle distance was like three quarter distance at Durham. That was a 17-mile run, an 80-mile bike, and a 2K swim.
Okay.
It takes seven and a bit hours. And then Nice took about 8 hours, and that was the long course.
Now that was the one that Mark Allen was famously dominating every year. Would it, the story there was always Yves Cordier leading and Mark Allen catching him on the run, a bit like, you know, the Dave Scott catching Mark Allen on the run in Kona, wasn't it?
It was, yeah, because Mark Allen won, I think, 10 times in these, didn't he, in the end?
Yeah. And that was always a puzzle to me, was like, how can he go and dominate there and then just crumble when he got to Kona? You know, I didn't understand that. And at the time, anyway, it just seemed to me like he was such a good athlete that it was just a matter of time before he would
He would
win in
dominate.
Kona. But it took him a while, didn't it, to get there?
And why do you think he didn't dominate Hawaiian?
I think it was, well, I think there was definitely a hex that Dave had over him. Dave felt like it was his race. Maybe Mark was trying too hard. You know, I've read all the stuff and talked to him about his, you know, being part of the island and the holistic stuff. I don't know. What about you? Why do you think he didn't win?
I think Dave targeted. They did Nice as well, and often what wasn't we didn't win, but he was certainly up there in the mix. I remember 83. He was in Team DJ David or something, with some of the other athletes. But looking at half and a full. If we look at age group athletes, there seems to be a different energy system for 5, 6 hours as there does to sort of 9 or 10 hours. There seems to be that dip where athletes seem to. So it may be that Dave was more efficient, say.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, because I remember watching, particularly in that 1989 race when they ran side by side, that Mark always looked like such a much smoother runner than Dave. Dave was quite a choppy, muscular stride, wasn't he? Mark seemed to flow. You might be right. I mean, maybe it was the fact that Dave targeted that race and came in peaked, and Mark had raced before, and you know, maybe he was just slightly off his game.
But often Nice was September and Hawaii was October. So yeah, although I'm very good at peaking now, and I probably wasn't quite so good at peaking then. I'm pretty sure reading the books that Dave and Mark did that they should have been able to peak for two races fairly close together.
But also you've got a peak for two races. But if you know, I can't ever remember Dave racing as much as Mark did in Nice. But you've also got that big transatlantic flight, haven't you, to get home from Nice, and then you've got to get over that 8 hour time, 9 hour time zone change to go to, well, plus another 3 hours. So you've got 12 hour time zone change to go to Kona. That takes a lot out of you. Even at their level, it's enough to make the difference on a race day between two elite athletes.
Yeah, and in my 20s, I never really thought about, the stress levels, the time zone levels, and how much that would affect you. But now I know that you've definitely got to arrive early, acclimatize, not get caught up in the hype, and start trying to keep up with everyone on the bike and the swim and the run. But certainly, the travel stress, I think people tend to neglect. They do all the training and then they fly out on the Friday to even a European race. Rack the bike Saturday and they're racing Sunday, and before they know it, they've had a bad race.
These, as a coach, Mark, these are things I think that, you know, that make the difference. There's lots of people providing athletes with training programs, but it's these little things that you talked about, being able to make mend punctures and minimize your stress, you know, making sure you change your tires, making sure you stay hydrated, taking into account the travel stress. Those are the things that your experience, or you built up through experience and years of racing, that I think a lot of coaches are missing out on.
Yeah, I mean, you and me, we definitely pass on that information to our clients, and I think some coaches just don't assume, they just assume it's okay, and and sometimes it isn't. But I've even known clients that have gone out on a Thursday and the bike's not arrived till the Saturday, and it's barely got built up before the Sunday. So that's not to say that if you go out early, you're not going to have a problem with your bike, but it does reduce a lot of those unnecessary stress levels, which I'm almost, you can almost plot it really. When someone, if someone comes to me now and they want Ironman coaching, I like to interview them first, really, to see if we can work together, but more importantly, to find out when they are going. Because if they're flying out to Europe and race on the Friday, or that, yes, I can help them, but I'd rather persuade them to go out earlier, not to make my life easier, but just to make their performance that much better.
That's an interesting point you make, Mark. I, like you, I've experienced athletes who have, maybe it's because they've, for work or family reasons, they haven't been able to get to a race early, but then their bike's been lost in transit and it's not turned up for the race. And so all of that time and effort they put in has been, you know, futile for that race, maybe not for another one. But also I've experienced, I used to coach a guy who was an under 23 GB athlete who was at Loughborough. And him and two or three other of the guys in the team went to Belgium to race. So all they had to do was drive from Loughborough to East Midlands Airport, which isn't very far, check in and get the bikes onto the plane and then sit around and, you know, and then get on the plane. An hour's flight across to, I think, I can't remember whether it was Belgium or Holland, but anyway, an hour's flight across there, across the North Sea, drive an hour to the destination, check in and then race the next day. Maybe the race, they went on the Friday and raced on the Sunday, and none of them raced very well. They were well below where they should have been compared to the people they were normally racing. And the next time they went over there, we got them to go on the Thursday, and that extra day of rest made a massive difference. And for me, that was really interesting, because here are some elite athletes in the prime of their life, and yet it still, that the impact of a day of traveling to 48 hours before a race had a significant impact. So how would it be for people in their 40s that are traveling across to America and on the plane for 8 hours? You know, it's big, isn't it?
It is big. Yeah, it's huge, really. If you're fortunate enough, or you want to go on business class, first class, but I still think you're better off going on economy class and going out a little bit earlier, really.
Yeah, for sure. Let's go back to the 80s and 90s then, Mark. So you said Ironbridge is one of your favourite races. Were there any races that you did you thought, I'm never going back to that, it was awful?
Yeah, well, the Peterborough Iron Distance race. It was a non-wetsuit swim, although you could wear a sort of like a shorty wetsuit. It was up and down the sort of dual carriageways then, as they were then. Now they're triple carriageways. But it was multiple laps, zigzags, ins and out, dog legs and things. And yeah, it just wasn't very well organised, really. I end up leading the bike, and I think I did about 7-8 miles extra on the bike. And it just wasn't a very good race. It was on open roads, as that most of the roads were open, but it was because it was dual carriageways. You had to go up and down the slip road rather than stay on the dual carriageway, and it just wasn't a very safe course, really. And that was back in the mid 80s.
I hope you're enjoying the show so far and learning a lot. If you aren't already a regular listener, I hope you feel you might come back. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so you know whenever a new episode arrives. I publish these twice a week, ad-free, and with the mission of improving the health and performance of endurance athletes around the world. And to help me, I'd love it if you could share the episode with one person you think could benefit. If you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show. Did you ever come up to do the Wakefield National Championships?
Yeah, I did. I've still got the results somewhere. I've come across them last Christmas, before Christmas.
So this is the one where the race was sort of basically dissolved about 5 kilometers into the bike because everybody went the wrong way, and then it was just reduced to a 10k run around the lake. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that one. Yes, yeah.
So I don't know what happened to you on there. I lived close enough to Wakefield to go and ride the course the week before, so I knew exactly where the bike ride went. And I knew that at the second roundabout, you went straight on and up the hill, up the long climb towards Denby Dale, and then across and round towards Emly Moor. So as I came out of the swim, you know, not super high up, but reasonably high up in my age group, there was a Boy Scout directing everybody back down to Pugney's where we just swum. And I'm thinking, that's not new. That's not right. And I'd seen lots of other cyclists going back, and I was thinking, well, maybe they're miles ahead of me and they've already done the course. So I ignored him and carried on. And then I rode all the way along, and I was expecting to get passed by all the Uber bikers, and I didn't. And I carried on, and I never saw anybody in front of me. And I thought, oh, well, must be last now then. Got back, and then there was all the other people just stood around in running kit. And there was, I know Ken McLaren was in front of me. I can't remember who else there was. There was probably two or three local guys. And then they said, oh, no, the race has been cancelled. You were all sent the wrong way. And I had a chat with Ken a few years later, and he said, we should have just carried on and done the run, because they would have had, you know, we'd have been the official winners.
Yeah. Well, I remember that the Wakefield triathlon where I came out the swim quite low down, and I thought I'd had a bad swim because everyone was coming back off the bike and I still had about 20 miles to go.
Yeah. So you'd have had a 1 kilometer bike ride then to the roundabout, and you'd have had then done a 10K run. Yeah.
But yeah, and those races were some of it was self navigation as well.
Yeah,
you know, there were the odd marshal or two, but you really had to know the course before, which was always a challenge because I didn't have a car, so I ended up having to sort of cycle the route the day before, really. But
that was the race that I first saw Tracy Harris, because I remember as everybody was walking around for the run, the sun had come out. There was this one guy with long blonde hair and sunglasses. And he was wearing the skimpiest pair of Speedos, Dayglow Speedos, and a matching crop top. And I'm like, what on earth? And who does that guy think he is? And then he won the 10K run. And I'm like, well, okay, then. Well, maybe he's okay wearing that kit.
Yeah, he was pretty phenomenal, really, wasn't he? Larger than life, so.
Yeah, yeah.
So it did attract lots of different characters, really, which made it a bit more enjoyable, really, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, what are the things that you miss about those days? And because obviously triathlon's come on a long way since then. Is there anything you'd like to have continued from the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, I like the low keyness of the event, really. So it still has to be safe and professional, but more you know, maybe smaller fields, there's less drafting, more novelty to the event. So it's maybe a bit more navigation, either on the bike or the run. So. Mm-hmm. If you do your research beforehand, you're going to be better off than someone that just turns up on the day. And that's not always possible. If if there are events in Wakefield like you could go and train on it, but I'd have to get up there beforehand or come up the weekend before or try it out. And not really have standard distances, because that makes it's a bit of an unknown then. You're not really sure how well you're going to do, because, and as you know, if you're in the Lake District, a short ride could be potentially look easy, but actually it's
yeah. Do you know, one of the things I like, you mentioned it earlier with one of your first events, and I remember that too, was there weren't any racks. You just go along and you know, like the Yorkshire Dales. I don't know if you ever did the Yorkshire Dales triathlon. You started at a reservoir right up on the moors, and I mean, this reservoir was in the bottom of this little valley. It's called Semmerwater. It's really cold, and when you get on your bike, you've got about 300 meters before you've got a 1-in-4 hill to get out to actually start the bike course. So that was the first challenge. But you basically just, when you got there, you just lent your bike up against a dry stone wall, and that was transition. Then when you finished the bike, you were in a field next to the pub, so you just found a bit of grass to lean your bike, drop your bike, or lean it up against the wall, and off you went. So that was good. The rustic nature of those events was great, you know. And there weren't any marshals on the course, and there weren't many arrows. So you did, or maybe there was one or two, but only at key points. So you definitely did have to have some either local knowledge or have driven around. So goodness knows what somebody like you would have done. You'd have come up the night before and then had to ride 50 miles around.
Yeah, and that's what I would have done anyway, because that would, I'd rather do, you know, I felt that riding the 50 miles beforehand and knowing the course, I would be better the next day. Obviously, yeah. Hindsight, I think I wouldn't be better, but I'd have no surprise. I'd be able to, you know when to drink, when to eat, the best time to stretch and stuff like that, really. But I did the Hillingdon Triathlon Series, which was actually the oldest UK triathlon series.
Okay.
It's 71 of their events.
Wow.
About 18-year period, really.
Mm.
But they originally started as a swim, bike, run, and then they, because it was a built-up area and they used to be in the evenings, then in the Sunday, it ended up being a swim, run, bike. So it split up the field a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And one favourite of mine, I did one of the Banana Man races in Reading.
Banana Man.
They had an ERTS race, which is in reverse triathlon, IRT race.
Yeah.
So it started with 10K run, then it was about a 30K bike, and then you dived in the swimming pool afterwards. So it was all about pacing yourself, getting yourself ready so you didn't get cramp in the swim. And so that, they were quite different.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I you know, it does make me wonder now why somebody hasn't taken this idea and thought, right, we're going to have a proper retro triathlon. We're going to have some hybrid distances. We're going to have no wetsuits, or a wetsuit that's basically a windsurfing wetsuit with the arms cut off. We're going to have bikes from the 90s, you know, like those Eroica cycling events. So you've got to have down tube shifters, no aero bars, no clip-on pedals, no disc wheels, no power meters. And you have to cycle in running kit as well.
Right. Okay. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, you got to cycle in running shorts with no padding and a t-shirt.
Yeah, so the 220 Triathlon magazine had its 25th anniversary quite a few years ago, and I approached them and said, you know, what are you thinking of doing? It'd be a good idea to sort of replicate that. And then we came up with the idea of there was two big Cal events, sprint races.
Yep.
Adam Bowden, I think he won both of them within he was about 30 seconds difference between the two particular races.
Mm.
First particular race, I borrowed a 7-speed Colin Argo bike with band shifters. I used an old retro, like a tri-suit wetsuit. I had a Kindle Mint Cake on the bike. And I had Bosch on the bike as well. And some old running shoes and did my shoelaces up. And then about 5 weeks later, I did the same race again. Adam Bowden wasn't that far apart from the first race to the second race, so conditions were pretty similar. And I used my, state of my art Vanquish Zone 3 wetsuit. I had a time trial bike with disc brakes and tri-spoke, and some racing shoes, elastic laces, and I was 6 minutes quicker.
How many? Sorry,
6 minutes in a sprint triathlon.
Wow,
which is huge.
Yeah, but like we talked about, it's not always about the time you do, is it? It's a nice experiment now. But I reckon that whilst people might chunter a bit about not being able to wear their expensive Nike Vaporflies or they have their aero bars on, just the fun of having to get all that equipment together and wearing it and doing it a different way would leave them with a great experience.
Or, you know, like we get age group categories, the over 60, as you're in the same age group as me now, the over 60 category, they should have a retro category. So it's literally non-wetsuit swim, a bike from the 70s and 80s, no carbon fiber shoes. And because I've been to some events where they've had to change the run route at the last minute and it has to be, but, you know, I say last minute, a week before, so you've had adequate notice to bring the right training apparel, and people have claimed because they can't use their carbon shoes, they've got to use a normal racing flat, really. But it's I think we sometimes get preoccupied with technology, really, and expecting it to help you perform. And if you don't, as you know, if you don't get the, you can have the best bike in the world, but if you don't have a bike fit, you don't know how to ride it.
Yeah.
If you use it at weekends, you ain't going to be able to perform to the best of your ability.
So remember back in those early days, were you right up on the tech or did you just turn up on a sort of like a rally or equivalent racing bike?
The first race, I had just a 7-speed rally bike with 38 spoke wheels. And then I went to the bike. After that, I realised that I'm starting to try to buy performance because I'm feeling, winter I can get fit on the bike and improve my swimming. But I went to the local bike shop and I've got a 531 tubing and 26 spoke wheels, and I've got tubulars then. I've ridden tubulars ever since, really, and tried to get the best possible equipment. I've got a more of an aero helmet, I would say, because I felt the cold coming out of the swim, and you didn't have to wear helmets back then. We all we had was like the mesh.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, was seen in the milk race back in the early sort of 70s and 80s. I wore more like a bell helmet, just to keep me warm, really, when I come out and swim.
I remember getting about the time they started bringing out aero things, they it was like a polystyrene helmet, but it had like a cover that went over it to try and make it more aero. Do you remember those?
I remember those. It literally was polystyrene, and then you could take the Specialized and a few others had these covers where you just took it off, washed it,
or
changed the color to match your kit, and apparently that was more aero, but I don't think it was more aero, really.
No, it wasn't. And I can remember in those first days I used to get a bit psyched out. I'd see people that were walking around looking really muscular or really lean, or they'd have great bikes, you know. And I remember there was a guy called Peter Coulson. Do you remember him?
Yes, I remember him.
I think he went on to be chairman of British Triathlon at one point, and his son Stuart was a great athlete. But I remember Peter, he had a chain of nursing homes in the Northeast, if memory serves me correct. And Peter, if you're listening, please correct me if I'm wrong. And I remember coming out of the swim and thinking, oh no, I'm rubbish here, because I was always a reasonable swimmer compared to everybody else. And then I get overtaken by all those people you mentioned earlier, the cyclists who couldn't swim. But I remember going along on my racing bike with my dropped handlebars and seeing this guy on this Kestrel. Do you remember those with the drop with the
with it's the white frame, normally white Kestrel?
That was right. Well, Peter Coulson had a white Kestrel, and I think at that time they were probably sponsors of they were the Ironman official bike sponsor. And I saw this bike, and I think he might even have had a disc wheel. I'm like, whoa. When I saw it, I thought, this guy must be brilliant to have a bike like that. And then I realized he was just quite a wealthy businessman, particularly when I saw him driving off with it on top of his Porsche 911 as he went home.
So I stayed with Peter Coulson and so he gave me a lot of advice and everything else, and I tried to ride his Kestrel bike and from his posh home at the time. But yeah, it was a bit of an experience.
He's a lovely bloke, Peter. But at that point, I didn't know who he was. I just remember passing this guy on a Kestrel bike and thinking, well, can't be all about the bike, because that guy should be leading.
And it's amazing how many times I see people on amazing bikes that they're in the wrong gear, or they've just done something wrong, or the back wheel's rubbing, and you think, well, you're going to ruin the frame anyway, but you're just slowing yourself down, really.
Yeah, or they've paid to have this really expensive carbon fibre set up at the front end, and then they're sitting on the bullhorns because it hurts their back to be in that really low aero position.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. But so I was quite a fourth in terms of trying to save time. I used to use the local postman used to have, he always dropping elastic bands all around the streets. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite thick. So for the early triathlons, I used to use, I found they were better for me than using shoelaces and toggles. The camping toggles, if you pulled them off and the spring would snap.
Yeah.
So not to let my competitors aware of what I was doing, the night before the race, I used to Tipex, the white Tipex, like a paint over the elastic laces, well, the elastic band laces, just so I could have a slight advantage.
Hold on a minute. So I'm just trying to envisage this. So you basically
took the shoelaces out.
You were going around. Where was it you live?
Dagenham in Essex.
Right, so you're going around Essex, you're picking up all of the big thick elastic bands that the postman's dropped when he's got undone all the packages that he's got. You're tying them together to make an elastic lace, and then you're taking the shoelaces out and replacing them with those, and then on top of that you're painting them white so people would think you're still using shoelaces.
Yes, but that would only last one or two races, really.
Brilliant.
Because as the elastic stretch, the Tipex would come off, but for the start of the race it always looked like you had these white funky.
You missed a trick there, Mark, because that must have been way before elastic laces were common in triathlon shoes. You could be talking to me from Cleanthus Towers right now.
I know, I could have been, really. I could have. And then where I worked in the food cache in Kerry, there was a butcher there, and you think, where's this conversation going? They used a dryer back in a heat machine and make things air pressured and tight to sell the lamb chops and the pork chops.
Yeah.
This heat machine, he used to make make things out of it. So I got him to put my cycle bottle and my cage in that machine and press it. I've got through quite a few strings bowls, but I had in 1984, I was the first person to have an aero drinks bottle on my bike that didn't leak.
Right.
And that was basically squash it using heat treatment.
Wow.
Originally we tried it with a bottle cage, but then the bottle cage would deform. So then you had to have a drinks bottle in there with some sort of water so it didn't completely deform, and then you could get it out, and then you had to keep changing it. So eventually you could get it in and out. So it made it more aerodynamic.
Wow, that's fantastic. I love the innovation there. Just imagine if you'd we were talking about skiing before, and if you'd been skiing and thought these ski poles, I could use some aero bars like this. If you'd done that in 1986.
Well, in 1987, I went to Hawaii to do the Ironman. And the DH bars at the Hawaii bike shop, Dave's bike shop, which is not there anymore, he was desperate to sell them after the Ironman because they arrived just around the Ironman time. And he physically couldn't deal with all the fixing people's bikes. People's bikes are horrendous back then. Just got them out of the shed, you know, like 3 days before. So I bought 5 pairs and I sold 4 pairs when I came back and used the pair. So they were the DH bars. I still got those, actually.
Right. So those were the ones that had a bit of a dip and then came round like a curly cow horn. Yeah. And there was another pair that were like a big triangle. They had like a cow horn going forwards and then just came round didn't have the curly bits, did they?
Yes. And they were thinner because I tried to get someone to make them more thinner. And then I was thinking, well, actually, I didn't really want to use handlebar tape because I felt that, you know, that would be more aerodynamic.
So
some events, because I had quite long hair then helmets weren't mandatory, I'd keep my, and if I was really cold, I'd actually cycle in my swim cap.
Oh, okay.
And keep warm. And then when I did get hot, I just put it down my tri-suit. So in the London Triathlon 1984, I finished third overall. And some of that was, there was a lot of faster runners, a lot of faster cyclists and swimmers. Colin Bateman, who still was on the retro group, he was a phenomenal cyclist, but I passed him and I had a skin suit, a cycling skin suit, where I got the local haberdashery shop to unstitch the chamois out of it. Because it wasn't like these modern synthetic chamois. It was almost like made of sheep wool back then. And then I used to stuff my inner tubes behind the saddle rather than have a saddle bag, just to make things a bit more aero. There was lots of little things that I was, you know, and I removed the dust caps because I felt that was extra centrifugal weight on the bike. There was lots of little quirky things that I was doing that a lot of people weren't doing.
The question about those aero bars. You got them in 1987. I think the first time the world really saw them was 1989, wasn't it? When Greg LeMond used them in the Tour to that sort of famous last day win. When you came across regular cyclists at that point, nobody was really aware of them. So what was their reaction to you using those?
Well, they didn't think they were because they were quicker than me, but generally they were just pure cyclists and I was new into cycling for 4 years. A couple of them said, well, you never catch me wearing one of those helmets you're wearing. I'd give up sport. And that would never take on. I recall watching Greg LeMond using them and winning the Tour de France by seconds over a 3-week race. And then surprisingly, on the following Wednesday at the time trial, everyone coming up and asking me how much did they save?
I had a similar experience. I got a pair before Greg LeMond had them, and turning up to a local time trial on a Wednesday night, and this bloke saying to me, what are those? And I said, oh, they're aero bars. He said, what you've got them on for? I said, well, because they're aerodynamic, it'll be faster. He went, well, they're dangerous because you can't reach your brakes. I'm like, yeah, but at least my head's up. How many time trialists have ridden into the back of cars because they've got their head down? Anyway, he said, anyway, they're stupid. They'll never take off and you'll never catch me. Exactly the same as what you said. And then at the end of the season, I was at this race, and guess who turned up with a pair of aero bars on his time trial bike? This guy. And he said, well, if you can't beat them, you've got to join them, haven't you? Yes. So, and I also remember riding along on a Sunday ride on my triathlon bike and having these bars on and being in them, and a pack of club cyclists going the other way, and people noticeably sitting up and pointing and laughing at them, you know, and sort of making comments about weird triathletes. It might have been also because I was riding on my Sunday ride wearing a pair of Speedos as well.
And I used to have, I felt the drinks bottle would be better in my top. So you come out of transition, I had a cold drink, put it in my top, and that didn't act like a fairing, but I felt that was more aerodynamic, and certainly the sprint races, than it would have been. And I had like a little straw, so I didn't even need to stop and drink.
I guess 30 years later, Christian Blumenfeld looked at some photos of you, Mark, and thought the same.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. To ask him actually where the idea from.
So look, let's fast forward to the current day. So you're still racing. Obviously, you've experienced a whole raft of innovations and changes and things since you started. Some of which you've been trying before they even hit the mainstream. Can you remember? Firstly, can you remember some of the things that came out that were a complete disaster?
Yes, Mark Allen. He had come out the swim, and he put a belt on, and he connected it to his headset, and apparently it gave him more leverage.
Okay, did it?
I think it might have gave him more leverage, maybe more watts, but maybe the time it took to put it on and take it off at the end of transition probably wasn't viable, really.
Did you try that then?
I did actually try it, but again, it was very fiddly, especially with cold hands, wet hands and things. Mm-hmm. But if you go back to, you know, riding on a turbo, say, as soon as you take your hands off, it's that much harder, isn't it?
Yeah.
So working on that theory that take your hands off the bike, you're not getting the leverage. If you move yourself in a particular way, or if you climb in a hill, you might push yourself further back on the saddle. And if you're time trialing, you might go on the tip of the saddle. But the problem with that was, if you were moving about on the saddle, moving back, moving forward, this strap was too tight or not tight enough. So you weren't really getting the leverage. But that was designed by Head, who produced the disc wheels.
Okay. Well, talking of disc wheels, did you have were they J discs? Do you remember those little plastic covers that you could clip onto your spokes? But every time I saw somebody wearing them, the clips had come undone and the thing was busy flapping about and catching on the seat stays and everything.
I spent so much time adjusting it during the race that it wasn't really worth it, to be honest. Yeah.
I can remember seeing Mike Pigg on a race that was televised. I think it might have been the Portsmouth race, where he had a seat shifter. Do you remember those?
I never tried that.
But it wasn't like a dropper post that you get on mountain bikes. It went backwards and forwards. So bit like your leverage thing there. You could move it back for climbing uphill and then move it forward, sit further forward on the saddle to make yourself more aero.
I felt that, you know, knowing what we know now compared to what we didn't know back then, I felt that that system would help, where you change it at the end of the race to change your position. Just to give you a better, so when you get off the bike, you find it a lot easier. But I think with the long nose saddles now, I think you've got that option to set it up so you can sit on the saddle correctly and then move forward still on the saddle and not use these, because they were quite heavy, some of these
because it was a bit like a lever that you probably would have had to have lifted your weight off the saddle and then pulled the lever, which would have moved it back. It's quite precarious, that, isn't it, if you're going at speed, and you wouldn't want to do it as you were trying to climb.
No, you wouldn't. But I remember seeing a few people trying to use them, and they were mechanically, they weren't really efficient at doing it at speed, really.
Anything else that you used that you thought looked great, but they didn't turn out to be quite so good?
Well, lots of hydration systems. The System 3 cycle shoes were one of the first type clip-in shoes, but you had to slide into them, and mm-hmm. then you had to put your foot down on a clip. And if you went round a corner, even with your foot up, sometimes you could clip the corner and then your foot would come out. So they were pretty precarious, really.
Yeah, you talked about hydration system. I think we talked before about that thing. It was like a balloon, but the rubbish was really heavy duty. So you could fill it full of water, and like a bit like a hot water bottle, but then it would have its own pressure to try and squeeze the water out. And the water would then go down a tube that you attached underneath your crossbar and up onto your handlebars. And then it would stick up like it was like a camelback nozzle. And then as you bit onto the mouthpiece with a little ball in it, the pressure of the, you know, the water bottle at the back would force the water out. The little mouthpiece wasn't particularly good. So often you get covered in a spray, and the inflatable bag at the back wasn't particularly brilliant. So they had a tendency to explode when you least wanted it to.
I know Ken McLaren, he designed something, maybe, I can't remember the time, but maybe before or after that system failed. But yeah, there was some of the aero helmets. I remember seeing people with the new aero helmets actually wearing the wrong way round.
Mm-hmm.
Not really, but I don't know if you've seen some of the recent photographs, have you, of some of the new helmets that are coming out?
Of these new ones that they're wearing in the tour, the Jumbo team,
yes,
have been wearing. Yeah, it does look like a cross between Darth Vader's helmet and one of those, and like somebody's put it on the wrong way around.
But yeah, so it's difficult to know if they're. I'm sure in a wind tunnel test they may be more efficient, but there's lots of things in a wind tunnel that seem great in theory, but actually are not. Yeah, often I've wondered, you know, I've not had access to a wind tunnel test, but often wondered, is it worth putting on, you know, overshoes, or, you know, not a winter overshoe, but a lycra overshoe or something similar onto a shoe, and how much are you going to save during a 180K bike and then take them off afterwards?
Well, I did talk to Dan Bigham about that, because he does a lot of aero testing stuff, but based on his, you know, background in Formula One. But also, and I know that he talks about the benefits from wearing those for time trialing, particularly the ones with the long socks that come up to your knee. But I think that if you were doing a triathlon, particularly where speed was of the essence, the few minutes it would take to put those on and get them right would negate any aero benefits you might get.
I still think, you know, we had the soft ride bikes and the booms and things.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember the slingshot. I remember seeing that at the Swindon Duathlon.
Yes.
And it was basically a frame with one of the tubes missing and a wire connected between two parts to give it the strength and stability and make it more aero. But maybe.
Well, I had a soft ride. I had the aluminium one that they had one with a curly beam, and then they had one with a straight beam. I had one of those, and I think I did my fastest Ironman on one of those. That was the day my legs felt the best. You know, I was never the sort of runner you were, Mark, but that was the day when I had my best marathon in an iron distance race, and that was after riding the soft ride. And the advertising blurb was always that the beam and the lack of seat tube would then reduce all the impact and the shock through your back, and that would make your legs fresher. Certainly seemed to work on that day, but I don't know if there was any substance to it.
I still think there's something we can do with the bikes to make the ride softer without having a suspension seat post.
Yeah, well, Ventum do something similar to that, don't they? And do you remember that Lotus bike as well? Was it the Hotter that came out that they had? Yeah.
Not sure about in the crosswinds from a little lightweight me, but I'm sure they would.
Well, and also that Giant bike that Christian Blumenfeld was riding, there was a bike like that Giant brought out in the 90s, because I remember Richard Allen had one. So it's not a new idea, is it, to have that big empty space in the middle?
But technology from the triangle hasn't really changed, and the wheels haven't really changed, apart from, you know, we now ride trial for folks. But and you go back to, you know, 13, it was really expensive to buy 13 or 14 mil Continental tyres, and now we've gone full circle, and now it's gone back to, you know, 25s, 23, 25, 28s.
I know.
Compared to what they were using in the Tour de France 100 years ago, which would have been that fat.
Well, I can remember looking around for, I had 19 mil tyres on and trying to find something even narrower. But I reckon if you tried that now, it would feel like you were riding those original bicycle wheels that were just wooden wheels with a rubber strip around them.
But yeah, occasionally you could get those prototypes, the MA40, Maverick MA40 rims, and they were a lot narrower. But then you needed a really thinner tub to stick on them. But then going full circle, now they're saying that, you know, you need a slightly bigger tyre than the rim, make it more aerodynamic. So it's difficult to know, really. And, you know, maybe 30 years ago, that would have been beneficial to me. But now I'm not riding at 50 kilometres an hour anymore. Well, I wasn't then, but, you know, I'm riding 32 kilometres an hour in a race. So it's not sure what the aerodynamic advantages are at the slower speeds.
Well, so here's the thing, Mark. I did a podcast with Phil Burt last year. Phil's a bike fitter who's worked with Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins and, you know, the British track cycling team up in Manchester. And we talked about, for older athletes like us, what are some of the things that we might want to think about to make life more comfortable. And he said having bigger tyres for the comfort factor, so your body doesn't get battered as much. He felt that Speedplay pedals might give you a little bit more movement around the foot to cope with tight knees, and maybe just the saddle as well. Some of the saddle designs are not designed for us old men. So there were definitely some comfort things. And his thoughts were, if you're doing 180 kilometer ride and you're on the bike for 6 hours, you definitely don't want to be feeling uncomfortable for three of those hours just because your equipment's too sort of, you know, tricky.
Yeah, too severe, really. Yeah, so even going back to the 80s, I always felt that comfort was more important than power. And my longevity in sport is because I listen to my body, really, and I'd always go for comfort rather than pain and discomfort. And I'd always try and listen to my body. I think I'm pretty in tune with my body in terms of knowing the difference between a niggle and an ache and a pain, and because I've only really had one major running injury, a couple of niggles, having covered, you know, 270,000 miles swimming, cycling and running. I've been really fortunate, I think. And that's, I think that's genetic. I just think that's because with triathlon, you've got swimming, cycling and running, you've got strength training, you've got cross training. There's lots of other things that you can do if you do get these issues.
Well, that's an interesting point you brought up, Mark, because I'm sort of always nattering on at people to, you know, particularly as you get older, to focus more on the mobility and the strength to keep the resilience up. Have you, throughout your 41 years in triathlon, have you always followed strength or mobility programs, or is that do you do it now, or is it something you've stayed away from?
I don't stretch, and I felt that every time I have stretched, it's caused a niggle or an ache. So it may be that I've not been shown how to stretch, or I'm pushing too hard in that stretch. If I do stretch occasionally, it might be after the workout rather than at the beginning of the workout, but that's more to lengthen or shorten muscle. Strength training, when I have done it, has definitely made a huge difference, really. And I certainly, now in my 60s, I'll be doing more strength training. And when you coach a client, they're quite happy to go out and do 100K on the bike. But if you ask them to do 70K on the bike and spend the other 30K strength and conditioning, they won't necessarily really appreciate that, the time that and the benefit they get from that and the injury prevention. I will certainly do more and more strength and conditioning. And when you hear of other athletes in their 70s and their 80s that have been doing sport a long time.
Yeah.
You know, they get the sleep, they get the rest, but they tend to reduce the quality of the training. So it's not the 80-20, it's probably 95 base training, 5% quality. But then they're getting their strength from the outside resistance training, strength training.
Yeah.
When I have done that strength training, I have surprised myself time and time again how quickly that sort of kicks in and how much benefit I get from that.
You mentioned earlier that about noticing the declining running most of all. Have you, you know, what other things have you noticed in the last 10 years that just feel harder to you to do.
You're in my age group, should I be sharing those with you?
Well, yeah, but at the moment I'm injured, Mark, so I wouldn't worry.
Okay, we've got probably 6 months out.
I do, yeah. Thanks for the reminder.
Swinginess. So if I'm going to do hard runs, I tend to do them. So if I'm going to do a hard part run, I'd rather do it on grass, or I'd rather do it off road. So yes, I'm not going to be as quick as a tarmac surface, but definitely the harder runs will be on. I wouldn't run in spikes off road. I'd rather run in a good pair of trail shoes. A lot of my training is run off road. So whether that's a canal, whether that's in the woods, so. And I felt that extra strength I've got has sort of somehow slowed down that decline.
Okay, yeah.
So, I mean, even in my 40s and 50s, my performance late 40s, my performance was declining, really. And despite me doing the interval type work with the running club, but my body wasn't really responding to that harsh running. So then I converted to running on off-road around the school field, parks and things like that. And I ran like 16:48 5K for a 50-year-old. And that was because I developed I was running a 400 meter on the track, maybe literally 4 seconds slower than I'd run on a tartan track or on the road. Uh-huh. But that, when I went back to the road, that actually gave me that extra springiness, that faster feet. And drills definitely help, fast feet drills, heel flicks and things like that. So do a warm up, do those types of drill exercise. Focus on the ones you're not good at as well, because they're the ones that you can get the real gains from without getting it. And those sort of things definitely help. Core strength and conditioning help. So I might tend to do it on a Concept 2 machine as opposed to doing the plank, for example.
Okay.
Repetitive. Strength for the swim, I might use resistance bands. But again, I would focus on 30 to 40 repetitions a minute as opposed to, 12, 14 repetitions a minute. So it's slow and fast. I'm trying to replicate the same muscle movements.
Right.
Swim. Maybe slightly less, but similar sort of, but creating a bit more resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that means I don't have to do as much aerobic training, as much top end training as I possibly needed to do in the past, really. But with the running definitely declined. So 30 years after I did my first triathlon, I was quicker 103s, 104s, non-wetsuit swims compared to 112s, 114s when I first took up triathlon. So I was swimmer, more efficient, quicker on the bike. But that, again, that comes down to equipment. But answering your question, the running is where we see that lack of springiness, lack of speed. And the idea is to delay the decline. So, in my 60s, I can still run a 320, 325 marathon, which, some people will be pleased with, let alone, a 60-year-old. But I'm trying to not, if I don't get injured, I'll be consistent and I won't lose decline.
Mark, have found that because you've been able to maintain your performance, actually, within, if you're looking at your position within the age group, there are less people competing now for various reasons. So in terms of the race of resilience, you're winning, or you're doing, you're ahead of most of the people there. Sure, you've got slower running 320 over a marathon to run 320, but I bet as part of your age group, there won't be many people that can run a 320 marathon.
No, so it's more about if you can't beat them, you outlive them, really. But I mean, outlive them in a healthy way. So some people literally would switch to an aqua bike because they can't run. But the runners in my age group potentially were quicker than me, maybe in the past. But because they got injured for one reason or another, they're not listening to their bodies. Then their decline is greater than mine. Some of that's down to consistency, some of that's down to lifestyle and sleep and recovery and everything else. But I now know, I believe I know my body really well. And after 40 odd years of running and staying relatively injury free, I must be doing something right for me. There's no magic formula for you or no magic formula for someone else. It's working within those constraints that we've got.
But do you know what's always struck me about you, Mark, is that you've every time I've met you, whether we've been at TCR, do you remember all those TCR shows that we used to go to? When I've met you at races, when I've seen you at the finish line, it's your enthusiasm. You know, you've always had this boundless enthusiasm. You've always been just enjoyed the sport. It's part of your, you know, if I cut you in half, it'd probably say triathlon through there, wouldn't it? Through your legs, through your arms, you know, or endurance sport. And I feel like that enthusiasm is, when I've seen it in other people, is what helps them keep going. So it's definitely something that I've noticed about you, is that just that always wanting to chat with people, always wanting to talk with them, you know, always wanting to have conversations, and, you know, just.
And always want to help people, and yeah. You know, that. But yeah, it's a passion. So, you know, people say, you know, when were you born? Well, I was born in 1960, but actually I was born in 1983 at the first triathlon, I feel. Like a birthday, really. It's just a matter of and I think you can learn from, you know, the elite. You can learn from other age groupers in your age group, you know, females. You can learn so much, you know, learn from errors that maybe they've made that you don't want to make yourself. And so, and sometimes I've chatted to someone and they've got absolutely no idea that, as far as they've known, that's the first ever triathlon I've ever been to. And it's only when someone comes up to them and says, "Oh, Mark, you're still competing 40 years later," they're a bit embarrassed, because I haven't actually spoken about me. I've just spoken about my passion, my enthusiasm. Mm. And I love sharing that experience. And if I can encourage one person every day to take up triathlon, then I feel like I've achieved something in life, really.
You know, I have this concept called the high performance human, which is all about, you know, spinning plates and, you know, doing well, not just as a swim, bike and runner and in athletic things, but in your life as well, with your nutrition and your sleep and your relationships. Do you pay any particular attention to what you eat, other than just eating a general all round healthy diet? Do you make any special adjustments to your lifestyle so you can get better sleep?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to get, you know, have all those systems in place, you know, have a quiet space, a dark space, not using the phone before, and, you know, readings particularly, and certainly have a better quality sleep. Have a reader, you know, I've got lots of books that I read all the time. And and I find that, you know, quality of sleep definitely makes a bigger difference when you're older. And if I skip a couple of nights of not having good sleep, that makes a big difference, really. But it's just trying to, and certainly with the clients I coach, you know, whether for ultra running, for marathons, triathlons, or Ironman, right, or even, you know, doubles and triple races.
Yeah.
Try to encourage them to, you know, 5 days a week as they possibly can. On their rest days, maybe have food that is a bit harder to digest. So if they're not vegetarian, maybe, you know, steak and things that they can absorb the food and the nutrients much better, really. So I don't drink alcohol. Just generally don't enjoy it. And if I had alcohol at even champagne or a wedding or something, I find it affects me for afterwards. Mm. So just a matter, it's finding that balance. So yeah, me and Claire have a healthy lifestyle. We tend to eat, you know, pretty healthily, but in the 95% of the time, but I find that just helps me with energy levels, enthusiasm, recovery rates. But that's, you know, it's not to say that I wouldn't have fish and chips occasionally, or, you know,
Well, there we have fish and chips, Mark, because if I was to pick a comic character that you would remind me of, you probably know who I'm going to say.
Remind me.
Alf Tupper, tough of the track.
Alf Tupper, yeah, of course, yes.
Do you remember Alf? He was always racing against the grammar school kids. He'd turn up in his spikes and his old vest and shirt, but he'd go off after a race, wouldn't he, where he'd beat everybody, and he'd have a big bag of fish and chips on the way home.
But if, you know, if that's what he was, what he aspired to and what he enjoyed, and then, you know, you could be a world champion if you smoked or if you had alcohol, but I think you'd be a better athlete and recover much better, and also you'd have a longer, when I met you in the late 80s, I didn't think I'd be talking about competing in triathlon for 40 years, but, you know, touch wood, I've been, not touch wood, but I've been healthy, fit. I'm still looking for new, you know, triathlon challenges, whether it's the Alpe d'Huez triathlon in the future, maybe, and Norseman, or so, there's always new challenges out there to do. And also age group challenges, not necessarily being second or third in my age group, which is obviously what I aspire to, but it's about trying to be pleased with my performance based on what I've got available, my low VO2 max, but the ability to cope with a high lactate and work around those parameters, really.
So let me ask you this question. In one of those info documents you sent me, you referred to an article in a paper where it said, is this Milton Keynes's
fittest
60-year-old? Did anyone come up and challenge you on that one? No one did, actually.
No one wanted to challenge me to a boxing race or swimming across the lake or 500 press-ups in a day. No one. So I'll keep that mantle until someone else claims to be the...
You have to, don't you? You have to state your claim, you know. You don't wait for somebody else to do it. Just say, all right, well, look, this is what I'm saying. Come and take it off me if you want. And
the records are to be broken, aren't they?
And what about the 41 years of triathlon? I know we talked to Margaret Sills and she'd retired after 40. Are you aware of anybody else, certainly in this country, that's been competing as long as you?
I'm 99% certain. No one from that first Reading triathlon or from the Northampton triathlon that competed that year has been competed.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of, but, you know, someone might surprise me. I've got documentation records, and if they do come up, then hopefully they're older than me.
Yeah.
And I outlive them. And I'm pretty sure with my healthy lifestyle, with Claire's support, I'll be able to continue going until I'm the longest triathlon competitor that's still competing since 1983.
Well, what we'll have to do is see if we can find somebody outside of this country, Mark, because there may have been triathlons that people did before 1983 in other parts of the world where somebody's still going. They won't have been going much longer than you, but...
I'm sure there might be an American that may be still competing because triathlon started in the US in 1978. I was fortunate to meet Dave Owalski at Ironman Ireland, and he did the first Iron Distance Triathlon 1978. But it's always be interesting to share some stories with them if they are around.
I tell you what, who was the one of the first winners of Ironman Hawaii? Was it Tom Warren or somebody like that? I think he might have done Kona a couple of years ago. So.
Whether he's still competing since 78, because I would.
Yeah, well, actually, that's another point. Is it's not just about whether he's still able to compete 40 odd years later. It's whether what he's been doing in the interim. I bet there aren't many people that have got 41 consecutive years.
I mean, I don't think, you know, a record for 29 iron distance races over 29 consecutive years is necessarily a record, because I think there probably would be other people that might.
Well.
But 40 is the next level up again, isn't it, really?
I think Kenny Glahr did 30 years consecutive in Kona, because I know he raced in 1989, didn't he? And I think he finished third or fourth in that year with Mark and Dave. So, and I know he was still racing up to COVID.
Yes.
So,
and I believe I started before him anyway. So if any caveat, I had maybe one or two years ahead of him. But
yeah.
To see if... maybe I'll drop him a line and maybe he'll devastate me. And so I'm the second person to have reached 40 years, but he's on 43 or something.
Well, we'll see. But it's amazing, Mark, that you're still going. I'm definitely going to use this title for the podcast. If you can't beat them, outlast them. 41 years and still going strong in triathlon with Mark Cleanthus.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. And I've looked forward to... maybe 50 years, another year. I haven't spoken to Claire about that, but another 9 years to go.
All right. Well, maybe we can coincide that with a milestone podcast episode as well.
Okay. Excellent.
Number 1,000.
Right. Okay. That sounds good to me then.
Mark, it's been great to catch up and really enjoy the reminiscing, and hope you stay fit, healthy and strong, and see it another finish line.
Yeah. Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure. It's given me some goose pimples reminiscing back on the last 4 decades, and I look forward to speaking to you and seeing you again at a race soon. Cheers.
Thank you again to Mark for being a guest on this week's show. I think we might have a long and arduous search to find anyone who's raced as many consecutive years as Mark. But if you think you know somebody who might have done, please let me know and we can try and get them onto the show. Now, there's a lot of stuff that Mark and I talked about in the show today, so please make sure you check out the show notes for links to all of those. And after you've done that, if you could share the episode with just one person you think could benefit, that would be amazing. And if you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. To make sure you don't miss any episodes in the future, please go to iTunes, search for my High Performance Human Triathlon podcast, and click on the subscribe button. All right, that's all for this week. Next week, I'll have another great guest, and I hope you'll be able to join me. But in the meantime, remember to check out those show notes for all the links I mentioned today, and enjoy the rest of your week.